This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. Steve Shoemaker is out of town this weekend, so I am taking his place. My name is Don Nolan, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Parkland. And this afternoon, we're going to have a very special guest, who's Dr. William C. Plaker. Dr. Plaker, are you on?
Yes, right here.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Dr. Plaker is the La Follette Distinguished Professor in Humanities in the Philosophy and Religious Studies Department at Wabash College. Is that right?
That's right. Crawfordsville, Indiana, just about 70, 80 miles east of you.
And you have just published a very interesting book entitled Callings, 20 Centuries of Christian Wisdom on Vocation. And we were going to talk to you this afternoon about that book. And I understand that this just came out. Is that right, through Erdmann's?
That's right. Came out about 3 weeks ago.
Both paperback and hardback, I understand?
That's right.
Well, I very much appreciate your being with us. Why don't we just make sure that our audience knows that this is a call-in program. If you at any point in time would like to address a question to Professor Plaker, you can call in at 333-9455. Or if you would prefer to call an 800 number, it's 1-800-222-9455. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about your interest in this book. How did you get inspired to write this book?
I'm not sure it's exactly inspiration, but I got invited by the Lilly Endowment originally to start thinking about it. They've been engaged in giving out some grants to religiously affiliated colleges and universities around the country to try to help young people think about how their lives are shaped by their faith, and particularly how their career choices are shaped by their faith. One of the hopes is to get more ministers, more priests, more rabbis, but also whatever careers young people choose, to have them think about it in terms of the faith or the ethical commitments that shape their lives. And in the process of doing this, they discovered that there really wasn't a good anthology of readings from the history of the Christian tradition on how do you think about what to do with your life in terms of your faith. So they asked me to try to put one together.
I was just getting ready to ask you, there are a number of books out on careers, vocations, and jobs, and how to think about work, and your special focus is on the Christian perspective on vocation.
That's right, and it's an anthology of readings that starts in the 2nd century and runs to the 20th century so that young people or older people can read for themselves different voices talking about how do you think about what to do with your life.
You title it 20 Centuries of Christian Wisdom on Vocation. I gather that this entails that there has been change or evolution over time within the Christian tradition about what the word vocation means?
That's right. When in the earliest days of the church, vocation and primarily meant deciding whether or not to be a Christian. In the New Testament itself, the word that we translate as calling or vocation doesn't mean a job. It means living out a Christian life. And in a world where Christians took some risks of martyrdom, even if they decided to become public in their faith, that was a big choice. Then in the Middle Ages, the primary decision was whether to commit your life to the church by being a priest, a nun, a monk, or whether to lead a secular life. And vocation meant almost exclusively a life in the what we might call the professions of the church. So then one of the big changes at the beginning of the Reformation was the idea that any kind of job, not just one in the church, but butchers and bakers and candlestick makers and whatever else, any kind of work could be a vocation, a calling, something that was what God wanted you to do.
So just to restate, early on, before the professions within the church arose, I assume this is prior to the Byzantine era.
Yeah.
What exactly did vocation mean again?
It meant deciding to be a Christian. That was your calling.
Just Christian in general terms.
Yeah.
What is the etymology of vocation?
Well, the vocation is just the Latin for calling. Vocare means to call. And so the idea, whether we say calling in English or they said vocation in Latin, was that this is what God wants you to do, God calls you to do with the shape of your life.
Now, I take it from what I have read just as an amateur that there has been a decline in seminary applications for professional vocations within both the Protestant and the Catholic traditions. Am I correct?
There's certainly a dramatic decline among Catholics. The Protestant picture is more complicated, and it varies from denomination to denomination, but it's certainly a worry that we're not getting the number of people we'd like to have.
You don't have any statistics on that?
I don't.
Okay. Exactly how do you structure your book? What is the organizational plan?
Okay, well, the organization is a historical one, starting with the early church. I have some martyrdom stories, some conversion stories, some things people wrote that convey to us what a serious decision it was simply to decide to become a Christian in the early church. And then chapter 2 looks at the Middle Ages, looks at how the life of commitment to the monastic life or the priesthood was a special decision in the Middle Ages. Chapter 3 starts with the Reformation and runs into the 17th century, and there we get this idea of any career, any job, being now a vocation to which one could be called by God. And then the final chapter runs up to more recent times and talks about all the complexities and confusions that we modern people have in trying to understand what we mean by vocation.
I know that within the Buddhist tradition, there's a focus on right occupation, right work, and also the Hindu tradition. How does the Christian tradition compare in that regard? Are there some? How do you know when you have opted for the wrong vocation or the right vocation?
There's not, of course, one answer in the tradition to that question. But in general, people say, "Well, you do a series of things." As the contemporary Christian theologian Frederick Buechner puts it, the best way to know is when your greatest gift fits with the world's greatest need. So you find something that you're good at, that you enjoy doing, and you find that it's something that the world needs to have done. And that kind of sense of fit is where a lot of people find their vocation.
In the Hindu tradition, vocation was tied, as I understand it, largely to the caste system.
Yeah.
There, as I understand it, there's no similar comparison within the European Christian tradition. But how would you know what set of vocations are, let's say, pseudo-vocations or false or dangerous?
Mm. Well, in talking about castes, you raise an important point, and that is that our modern sense that that young people would have today, that, gee, there's a whole range of different jobs I could take. That's pretty new, even in the West. Until the last couple hundred years, I suppose, for the vast majority of Christians, you did what your parents had done. You didn't have a much opportunity to say, gee, dude, what career do I want to go into? So while we haven't had castes, in practice, we often had something pretty close to it. But now, your question was, how do I know when I've made the wrong choice? The standard answer, I think, throughout most of the history was that a true vocation ought to serve the society of which you're a part. And so something that wasn't contributing to the good of your neighbors in some way or other, and in particular something that was doing them harm rather than good, that probably wasn't an authentic vocation. Now, you could still find something that was a good vocation and just not a good vocation for you, but that's a different question.
Well, let me just push this to the to its logical conclusion.
Sure.
Can you be a Christian prostitute as
no,
a vocation?
The tradition would have said, because in doing that, you wouldn't have been serving the good of your neighbors. You would have been corrupting them rather than helping them.
And this is a consensus within the Christian tradition?
Yeah.
So is there a set of kinds of vocations that are inimical to or incompatible with doing good for the community?
Sure. I mean, you could in some sense be a good thief, I suppose, in the sense of being skilled at it.
Robin Hood?
Robin Hood is a complicated story, isn't it? He, after all, didn't merely take from the rich, but he gave to the poor.
Mm-hmm.
But assuming the more common standard version of a thief who just kept it for himself, I think that's something that one couldn't really have a Christian vocation for. In the Reformation period, people talk about useless things. I mean, they're not harmful, but some of the more radical Puritans would have said, well, if you're making lace, I mean, people don't really need lace, and that's not simple clothing of the sort that Christians ought to wear. And so they would even have gone to the extreme of saying that people who make luxuries and ornamentation and things like that are not really serving proper vocations.
So I gather from what you're saying is that there's a great deal of contention within the tradition about what counts as good and bad vocations.
Absolutely. I mean, the consensus principle is, well, what serves a good Christian society? But then as Christians disagree about what a good Christian society looks like, they'll come up with different answers about what's an appropriate vocation.
Let me just take a minute to give our number again. In case you'd like to present a question to Professor Plaker, you can call 333-9455 or, if you prefer, 1-800-222-9455. Well, let me just push this a little bit further. There's a question that seems to have become very popular in some Christian communities. What would Jesus do? Is it clear how or what methodology within the Christian tradition you use in order to find your vocation, or is it a matter? Is it essentially a mystery? How does one discover one's vocation?
Well, there is a varied pictures throughout the history, as you might expect, of the method of discernment. One 17th century English writer, William Perkins, who writes a famous book on vocation, talks about, in a fairly commonsensical way, well, read the Bible, pray, talk to your friends about what you seem to be good at.
And it will come to you?
Hmm?
And then it will come to you?
And then it will come to you.
Mm-hmm. That's almost a Gnostic way of presenting it as a mystery.
Yeah, I suppose so. But it's not meant to be utterly mysterious. I mean, he thinks there are empirical factors. He talks about how, well, if you think you're called to do something and you find you're incompetent at it, that's probably a pretty good sign that that wasn't your calling.
In the Bhagavad Gita, the general Arjuna encounters a moment when he's about to lower his hand to start a war, and he pleads with Vishnu, and he says, I'm afraid to make this decision. And Vishnu advises Arjuna, and he says, if you are a Kshatriya general, then you will discover what it is that you need to discover in order to do what you need to do, given your role in life. That's a fairly well-defined methodology. Are there any other methodologies besides Perkins that are within the tradition? Methods, as you put it, of discernment?
Well, in some traditions, one would consult a spiritual director. Catholics have done that for a long time. Some Protestants are beginning to find that practice useful, a way of finding someone wise in matters spiritual who can help you sort out what's really important in your life. I think we Protestants for a long time were in the habit of thinking that, by golly, we did all these things for ourselves. But it's interesting that even Martin Luther, when he writes about vocation, says, well, I want to assert my freedom and say that I don't have to consult a priest, but he says I'd hate to give up the opportunity to, because often I've learned much from such experience.
There is that Reformation tradition of the priesthood of all believers. Was that a significant change within the Christian tradition with the rise of Protestantism in defining vocation?
Oh, absolutely. Because it went both ways. Protestants said, well, we're all priests in a certain sense. But then they also said, which was new, that in all of us, whatever our jobs, we have vocation. I mean, until quite recently, say the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s, when Catholics talked about vocation, even in modern times, they meant almost exclusively, well, I'm going to be a priest, I'm going to be a nun, I'm going to be a monk. If you asked a Catholic, maybe even today, but certainly a generation ago, do you have a vocation? That didn't mean, well, yeah, I'm going to be a doctor. It meant those jobs within the church. So when Protestants like Luther, like Calvin, said right at the start, not only that all believers are in a way priests, but that all jobs can be considered callings from God and of equal importance, that was a radically new idea.
The Catholic Church, as you mentioned earlier, is experiencing a decline in seminary applications and in people choosing to go into the priesthood. What is causing that to happen? Doesn't that suggest that there are social and cultural, perhaps even economic or demographic factors that are affecting the availability of vocations? What is your take on why this is happening?
Sure. I mean, part of it is that the ministry or the priesthood, I think this is an issue for Protestants too, although not so much, is not as prestigious a calling, let's say, as it used to be.
The more secular we become.
The more secular we become, indeed. You think of several generations ago when the church was the dominant building in the town, the local minister might well be one of the two or three most educated people in a small town. You know, that was a very honored position. And I think it's still a wonderful calling. And my friends who are ministers talk to me about how what a wonderful thing it is to be with people when they give birth, when they face the death of someone in their families, and to be able to support them. And I mean, I think it turns out in private contexts, it's still an immensely rewarding, immensely important calling in our society,
but not as publicly the ministry. Uh-huh.
But I don't think that's as publicly obvious as it used to be, and so many of our brightest and best young people don't feel that as a natural calling, and for Protestants, that's they can sort of say, well, maybe I'll give it a try. But for Catholics, I think, frankly, the limitation of celibacy of the priesthood makes that sort of sense of maybe giving it a try a much, much harder commitment to make.
Mm-hmm. Just a little bit about your background. You are a La Follette Distinguished Professor in the Humanities. How long have you been at Wabash College?
This is my 32nd year.
Ah, been there quite a while.
Been there quite a while. And that's on the faculty. I was actually an undergraduate before that. I grew up in Peoria, in Illinois, and so I've, over nearly 40 years now, gotten to know the road that goes through Champaign between Crawfordsville and Peoria pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider your own career choice as a vocation?
Oh, absolutely.
In what sense?
Well, I think it's the passage I quoted from Fred Buechner earlier, I think fits it. Namely, I found something that enabled me to take what I was good at and love doing, and find that it really connected with something that served others, and that combination made it feel right.
Is there any sense within the tradition that you could have multiple vocations, or is it always there is one that God has chosen for you?
That's another issue that gets widely debated. Luther tended to think that one should regard people who wanted to switch jobs with some suspicion. He thought that you found your niche and you stayed put. Calvin, on the other hand, was a little more open to the possibility that people might change vocations. So in terms of jobs, that's one issue. Another issue about multiple vocations is that lots of people thought that you might have both a vocation to do your work and also a vocation as a husband or wife, a parent. So in that sense, you could have multiple vocations.
Mm-hmm. At different levels, personally,
yeah.
Professionally, within the community, and so on, insofar as we all have different roles and parts to play in our lives.
Right.
I see. I suppose one of the more tragic things one might discover about one's life is that you missed your calling or missed your vocation. What does the tradition have to say to people who feel that has happened to them?
Well, it's a complicated business. The question, first of all, is does everybody have a vocation? Is there one thing that God wants you to do and everything else is a mistake? Or are there several different things that God could be equally pleased to have you do? and you need to pick the right one. Or you could pick any of them would be right. That's a complicated thing in itself. And beyond that, well, could you just miss it? Different people have different answers to that. That, of course, gets into all kinds of questions about free will and divine plan, and as different theologians have different answers about that,
that's where I was going.
Different answers about whether we could miss our vocation.
Where was Calvin on that? You mentioned that Calvin was a little bit more liberal in the possibility that one can have multiple vocations, but Calvin was quite a determinist himself, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. And he tended to think that what God wanted you to do was, by golly, what you were going to end up doing.
Whether you liked it or not.
Whether you liked it or not.
So you didn't really need to worry about searching for your vocation. It was going to happen to you.
Well, there's a famous story about a Calvinist minister who was Stonewall Jackson's chaplain during the Civil War, and he was seen in the midst of battle hiding behind a rock, and somebody asked him, well, why are you hiding behind that rock? You're surely either predestined to be shot or not. And his reply was famously that he was predestined not to be shot because he was predestined to be hiding behind that rock.
That's an endless circle.
Yeah. So I think, a lot of Calvinists would have said, well, I'm called to do something, but I'm called to search as the way that God has planned for me to find what it is that God intends that I should do.
Now, you've used callings as your main, that's the title of your book, Callings.
Yeah.
That's not really exactly the same thing as a vocation, is it? What is a calling? How do we understand that within the tradition?
Well, I think they're really the same word. Vocation is just a fancy Latin version of it.
I see.
I think one can identify different historical periods when either of those terms can mean different things, as I've tried to suggest. But I don't know that I'd sort of put all the weight on callings meaning one thing and vocations meaning something different.
Mm-hmm. I recently heard a minister say that he once preached as a very young minister at Martin Luther King's church, and was very timid and unsure of himself until someone on the first row started calling him out by saying amen and standing up and clapping and so on. And this was the moment when it became clear to him what his voice was, as a pastor. I've heard that association with voca as voice, that somehow or another it is called out of you by circumstances, by the life situation that you find yourself in. Have you come across examples within the tradition of thinking of it that way?
Oh, absolutely. That is...
In other words, you search and you pray and you don't find, but if you go and do and perform actions, it'll come to you.
That's right. Luther says the first question I ought to ask is what needs doing? Mm. And he says even... with typical Luther kind of extremism, says if the town needs an executioner and nobody else is willing to do it, then you ought to step up and be the town executioner.
Now, that's an interesting twist. That certainly is more compatible with the American capitalist tradition, what needs doing as opposed to what ought I to believe. I did want to ask you the question, can you? I assume you can be called to be a capitalist. Many in the left within the Christian tradition today have challenged capitalism.
Well, certainly you can be called to be a businessman, and you can be called to be a craftsman, and you can be called to be a banker. I think in the most aspects of the tradition, people would have said you can't be called to be somebody whose sole concern is how much money they can make,
right,
rather than thinking about how making a product or performing a service is going to help people, is going to help your customers, is going to help your employees. But then others, of course, would say that the best capitalists are precisely those who do think about questions like that.
Insofar as they create jobs and spread wealth?
Absolutely.
Some would argue that creating jobs and spreading wealth is an after effect of an egoistic, self-interested life plan. Those who are the most self-interested tend to produce the most capital. Isn't there an incompatibility there in terms of Christian vocation? It seems to me that if you take Christ's radical altruism to heart, being self-interested is incompatible with it.
I think that's right. If your motive is purely, let's see what I can get out of this for me, then that isn't what I think most Christians down the centuries have thought it meant to follow Jesus. But on the other hand, if I suppose a certain kind of capitalist, I think Adam Smith sometimes made this argument that that if you wanted to help others, the best way to think about what product they most wanted would be to think about, well, how can I make the most money at this? But
mm-hmm.
But if your ultimate goal was not the selfish one, but rather the one of serving others, I mean, in practice, you might do pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, as I recall, Adam Smith did argue for the virtue of moral sensibility among the shopkeepers as they were
making
money.
That's right, yes.
What are some of the favorite examples, your favorite examples of these different stages of vocation? What are some good examples of a vocation in the early Christian period?
My favorite, I suppose, is some of the early martyrdom stories. We have in some cases what seem to be accounts of people ready to, written by themselves from prison, men and women, ready and expecting to face death, a death which then in fact shortly came on them. And in those stories, you get a sense of how powerful their faith was and of how compelling, I think, the witness of martyrdom was in the growth of the church. It's, I think, clear that one of the reasons that people were attracted to the Christian church in the early days was that they saw these people who were willing to risk everything for their Christian faith, and so they stood up and thought, gee, this, there's got to be something in this if it so draws people.
And in the second phase that you mentioned, the focus on professions, I'm reminded of St. Francis of Assisi seeming to feel a calling to generalize the presence of God, not just among men, but in the larger world. And yet he was challenged by the powers that be. In the period of the, in the medieval period, were professions, was there significant disagreement in how one determines what's a right vocation?
Oh, yes, and even competition. I include in the text some sort of funny letters that go back and forth between different monastic orders. It reads almost like college admissions departments these days trying to compete for prospective students. One will say, oh, well, you know, those other folk over there, they they really don't have authentic vocations at all, and they live in luxury, and they're not faithful. And then another will say, oh, well, those people are extremists, and they're too tough, and they're too demanding, and you don't want to go there. And so you get, and on a less serious note, that sense of people arguing about vocations and competing for the callings of young people that they wanted to attract to their communities.
Let me come back to that in just one second. Let me give our number out one more time if you have a question to put to Professor Plaker. Our number here is 333-9455. It's the same as 333-WILL. You can also call an 800 number, 800-222-9455, if you'd like to present a question to Professor Plaker about this general question of vocation and 20 centuries of Christian wisdom on this topic. Well, it does appear to me that the question of what is an authentic vocation plays a much more significant role in the second period during the medieval era, as schools and doctrine became sharpened and contrasting more so than in the early Christian era. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Though, again, the particular feature, I think, of the Middle Ages was that that this was an issue really only for people who thought of a career within the church, that for the majority of Christians who were going to be shopkeepers or farmers or even princes and kings, they wouldn't have used the term vocation to describe what they were going to do. That was it was reserved for lives within the church.
How did the change come about to the present day, as you say, thinking of essentially any job as a vocation?
Well, it was a very conscious decision at the time of the Reformation. You can read Calvin, for instance, the founder of the Reformed tradition, saying that that one of the things we ought to emphasize is that anybody who's doing a good work for the community, whether that's ruling or praying or tending farm animals or cleaning the garbage, whatever you do, he says, you should be willing to think of that as a calling that that God has given to you. And so initially, it was a very dramatically democratic impulse that we were no longer going to divide society into the people at the top who had callings and everybody else who just went about doing whatever they were doing. But now this more democratic Protestant spirit was going to see that God had a plan for everybody's life. And so we would think about everybody's life's work as a calling given to them.
It sounds to me like it was contiguous with the rise of the Protestant work ethic. Is that fair?
That's right. And I think that's one of the dangers. I mean, I've given the kind of positive side of this, that it took everybody doing whatever they were doing and said there's real value in what you're doing and God cares about it. But one of the dangers of that sense that everybody's job is a calling from God is that it risked making people a little obsessive, or sometimes more than a little obsessive, about their jobs. And people were apt to become sort of committed and thinking that everything else had to be put aside, that everything else was less important, that they had to put as much time and as much work as they possibly could in doing their job well, and we still suffer some of the consequences of that way of thinking about our jobs.
So there is a tradition that says balance is important with respect to your vocation versus the rest of your life?
There is such a tradition, but it often gets lost, particularly, I think, in the Puritan side of the Protestant tradition, where work was sometimes seems like the ideal. And at least in those earlier folk, those Puritans, we had a kind of religious motive behind that, and so something to inspire it. But the sad thing is that too often now we've preserved the obsession with work without any kind of religious motive to inspire it, and it just is the kind of grind of endless labor.
Well, some people distinguish between good stress and bad stress. If you have a vision of life, a calling, I suppose obsession becomes a virtue, not a vice.
That's right. And I might mention, too, that one of the issues that I think we face very much in the modern age is whether it makes sense to think that everybody has a calling. You and I have both had the opportunity to spend a good part of our lives involved in teaching, and that's a rewarding kind of task. There are a lot of people that have to put bread on the table by doing something that doesn't seem to have a lot of purpose to it, that doesn't seem to have a lot of satisfaction that goes with it. And I think one of the debates in contemporary discussions of callings is it really fair to people to take all kinds of folk and say, let's think of them as expecting them to have a calling too, or does a calling become a kind of privilege that's not accessible to everybody?
Such as a part-time job at Walmart?
Yeah, indeed.
Is it appropriate or inappropriate to think of that as a vocation?
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I've never had to do that kind of job for very long. I think some people can find in such a task, they're helping others, they're being a cheerful co-worker with the people they're working with. They can find that even what might seem to many of the rest of us as not very satisfying work is to them satisfying, and they can find a feeling of purpose in it.
One man's drudgery is another person's vocation.
Exactly. But I don't know that those of us, if somebody from the inside can say that, I think that's wonderful. I'm not sure those of us who look at a job like that from the outside have the right to say, well, you should feel really good about your job.
Well, let me just introduce a little Marxist language here. Are there false vocations? I mentioned this earlier, and connected to that, has Christian doctrine about vocation been abused by the powers that be, as many Marxists probably would insist?
Oh, there's no doubt of that.
Imposing the status quo, so to speak.
Sure. In sometimes it was a way of saying, keep doing what you're doing and be satisfied with it and shut up and don't complain.
That's your role in life.
That's your role in life. That's right. But other times it was a way of inviting people to imagine an alternative role in life. The person who said, I think my calling isn't just to do what my parents did before me, but is to do something different. Sometimes, it's a complicated story, and there are lots of different episodes in it, and sometimes it was demeaning, and sometimes it was liberating.
What are some gender differences in how Christians have theorized about vocation?
Until very recently, probably the last two generations, gender was the most important distinction among people, I think, when it came to vocation, because the dominant picture since the Reformation really had been this, and in other ways that I'll get to in a minute, of course, before then, had been a notion that men's vocation was to go out from the home and do some kind of work there, whereas women's vocation was to stay in the home and do their work there. And that increased as the modern age developed. Before the modern time, most people, everybody stayed home in the sense that you were on the farm and everybody was doing the farm work, or you were in the place that made whatever you made, linen or woodworking, and the children were underfoot, and father and mother were both there, and to be sure, father was often doing the heavier labor. But it was really the beginning of the modern age. This again begins to sound a little Marxist, where the man went off from home to the factory to work, that the difference became much more sharply defined between the worker outside the home and the worker inside the home.
Professor Plaker, we have a caller. Just a second.
Yeah.
Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question?
Yes, hi. I tuned in sort of late because we had a guest at the door. You may have covered this before, but my question is, I was very happy in hospice and had lots of energy, and suddenly illness happened, which I didn't want at all. But what do you do when that happens? I want to hear the professor's response to that. I have not read the book, by the way.
Well, that's a very good question. I think sometimes illness feels like the end of a vocation. We've made a contribution to life in doing our work, in doing our job, and now that has come to an end, and it's time for others to take care of us. But sometimes I think, if this doesn't sound too strange, that being a patient can itself be a calling for a part of our lives, that sometimes what we're to do is to let others help us and be willing to accept that graciously, and that can be what our circumstances call us to do. And I think, lots of us can think about friends and family members who have made a real kind of witness by the way they lived their life in time of illness and the way they inspired others. My next door neighbor is a quadriplegic, and he can't, as we'd say, he can't hold a job anymore. But he's an amazing man, and I think he has a, in a very strange way, he has a kind of calling.
This reminds me of what many observed with the dying and subsequent death of Pope John Paul. He seemed to do it as an example to many people of how to die gracefully.
Yes, yes, and I think that's exactly right, and that he would have thought of that as the calling of the last part of his life.
The caller reminds me that I suppose that many who feel they have a vocation can have it interrupted by a major disease and facing death, a sense of incompleteness. I'm sure there's literature within the Christian tradition to help someone come to terms with this harsh verdict that your business may seem unfinished, but nonetheless it is.
Well, that's right, and it's not a Christian text, but there's a wonderful line in one of the Stoics where talks about there's a five act play, but it happens your part is only for the first three acts, and what matters is that you play your part well, and not how many acts your character appears in.
Whatever part you're given.
Whatever part you're given, exactly. Beyond that, I think one of the things that this kind of reflection leads, and one of the points I try to make in the book, is that we now, at this point in the history of Christianity, can draw on all the resources of different periods in the life of the church. And maybe we can get away from the sort of post-Reformation idea that focused on the job as exclusively the meaning of vocation, and can also recover some of that wisdom from the early church, where they had the idea that simply leading a Christian life could be a vocation, and that's something one can do in any circumstance.
It certainly is a rich and complex tradition. Have you identified any theoretical schools of thought or ways of thinking about vocation within the tradition that dominate two or three?
Well, I guess I'd come back to my four historical periods again. The early church, where the key thing is one is called to be a Christian. The Middle Ages, where one was called to be a priest, a monk, or a nun. The Reformation, post-Reformation period, where one was called to any job. And then I think our modern period, where maybe we can draw on the wisdom of all three earlier periods, among other things, to realize that our job needn't be the sole center of our lives.
What are some of the, I take it that your audience is students, or is it a broader audience than that?
The primary market, I guess, to put it that way, audience, is we'd like to think of this as something for college students, for high school students, in church groups, for seminarians, because in our society, it's mostly young people who do make these decisions and are preoccupied with these decisions about what they're going to do with their lives. But it's an issue that can, as that caller earlier reminded us, sort of hit one at any point in life. And I was pleased to notice I was over in Indianapolis yesterday, and there was a copy of the book in the Borders bookstore. So certainly people at a lot of different points in their life might want to think about what does it mean to have God calling you.
How are students today thinking about this topic? Have you identified patterns within the student body?
I think young people are suddenly much more willing to think about the pattern of their lives in terms of their religious faith or their ethical commitments.
Why is that so?
Well, I don't know. I think we went through a period, it seems to me, and you've had a lot of teaching experience too, where the successful career, meaning the making of a lot of money, was the kind of core value of our society. And I think in some ways we're getting a very interesting generation now of young people who've seen that played out, who've seen often their parents very successful in all the monetary ways that one could hope for, and yet still finding their lives in one way or another unsatisfactory. And so these young people are looking for something more, something different. I see a lot of college students at our place thinking about Peace Corps, about AmeriCorps, about Teach for America, at least looking for something that that can give them a sense of satisfaction, a sense of contributing to some kind of good, some kind of higher purpose that's more than just making a lot of money.
Of course, I'm sure at Wabash College you get students primarily who can afford to go to college. By the way, what's the tuition rate at Wabash these days?
I can never remember the tuition. I would have to say that
plus or minus.
About 80% of our students receive some kind of financial aid, and about half of them are still guys who are in the first generation in their family to go to college. So we're not entirely an elitist sort of place.
I didn't mean to suggest that. I'm just saying that students in college in general have, to some extent, if they're not working two jobs to put themselves through college, time to reflect on vocation.
That's right.
But
yes,
there's
sure.
This huge body of other folks, as we're reminded after watching all of the television broadcasts down in New Orleans, who don't have those options and choices, and in fact have had their entire vocations washed away. That seems to me to be a whole other area of reflection for Christian thought today, I should imagine.
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the things that we think of as individuals is, how can I live my life in a way that serves my society? But clearly one of the things we need to think of as a society is, how can we create a society in which individuals, as many as possible, have the opportunity to think about issues like that. And you're exactly right that at the moment in our society, there are an awful lot of people who don't have the liberty to think about such issues. And that's been true, of course, all through history.
Well, Professor William Plaker, thank you very much for joining us and talking with us about your new book entitled Callings, 20 Centuries of Christian Wisdom on Vocation, published by Erdmans. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Don. I've enjoyed the conversation.
This is Don Nolan, and this is Keeping the Faith. Thank you for being with us.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Linda Ellerby believes in taking big bites, and she's not just talking about food. Ellerby likes to take big bites out of elsewhere. In fact, that's the way she defines adventure. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program, To the Best of Our Knowledge, journalist Linda Ellerby tells about her edible journeys around the world. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. Don't miss your chance to win one of a dozen fabulous prizes for your home in the WILL sweepstakes. Time's running out, though. Your entry must be postmarked by September 6th to win the home or garden grand prize, the embroidery machine, or the elegant window treatments. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy this evening, then clearing, the low in the upper 50s with light winds. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high in the mid-80s and light winds, becoming southeast around 10 miles per hour in the afternoon. Tomorrow night, mostly clear with the low in the upper 50s and southeast winds around 10 miles per hour in the evening, becoming light. WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.